1945, and the end of the Second World War is in sight, but only if we could sweep away the last German resistance. On the 23rd, 24th of March, the Allies mounted their biggest push so far, the Rhine crossing. At 10 o'clock on the morning of the 24th, the men of the 6th Airborne Division, 2nd Battalion Ochsenbach's Light Infantry, the men who had so gallantly taken and held the now famous Pegasus Bridge during the Normandy landing the previous year, now, once again, spearheaded the advance, in preparation for the land troops who crossed the night before, who follow in their wake. A small group of these airborne commandos was to find a pocket of tenacious resistance in and around the town of Hammenkeln. Their orders, to take and to hold. Among the men in the very first glider to make a safe landing was Sergeant Robert Hill, aged 33. This is for him, to remind him of the brave pilot who took him in, and to remind him of his friends and comrades in arms, the ones who came back, the ones who were lost, and to say thank you. This is for you, Uncle Bob, with my love. Richard Dimbleby sets the scene as he takes you back to that morning on March the 24th, 1945, at the start of the glider takeoff.
Now we're moving out of our position on the flank of the runway and into the middle of the track, taking up the strain on our tow rope so that the Hamilcar 277 comes up behind us, the engines are being revved up to their full peak, and we are off. Forward down the runway, gathering speed quite steadily, watching and waiting for the glider behind to lift from the ground. Full boost now, flat out, forward, as hard as we can go down the runway. And the Hamilcar is lifting. The Hamilcar has risen up behind us into the air. I'm holding on my grid left now, we're bumping slightly down the runway. The navigator's holding the throttle wide open. Down we go, gathering speed, heavier and heavier, faster and faster. Now we're beginning to lift slightly. In another half minute, we shall be airborne. Pilot's holding her, and we're off. We're off the ground, we're climbing gently into the air. The glider riding steadily behind us, following in the line of aircraft and gliders that I can see wheeling away to starboard ahead of us. We're in the air, and we are on the way.
Hello, glider. Stag pilot calling.
Hello, stag pilot. Glider pilot answering. What's your message?
Hello, glider pilot. Is everything okay at your end?
Hello, stag pilot. Yes, everything's fine, thank you.
Good show.
Also on that flight, in another glider, was Stanley Maxted. He describes the scene as they fly on over the Rhine.
Stanley Maxted in the glider here. Well, it won't be long now. The men have all taken off their life belts and have taken a last business-like look at their automatic rifles. It must soon be time to cast off. Remember, these men were the first to land on D-Day. Remember? So, Richard Dimbleby, tell them when you get back about these guys and how they went into battle again. Tell Britain, Richard. Tell the world.
And he did. This is, once again, Richard Dimbleby.
We are coming up to the Rhine.
Right,
the Rhine lies left and right across our path below us, shining in the sunlight, wide and with sweeping curves. And the whole of this mighty airborne army is now crossing and filling the whole sky. We haven't come as far as this without some loss. On our right-hand side, a Dakota has just gone down in flames. We watched it go to the ground, and I've just seen the parachutes of it blossoming and floating down towards the river. Above us and below us, and collecting close round us now, are the tugs as they take their gliders in. Down there is the smoke of battle. There is the smoke screen laid by the army, lying right across the far bank of the river. Dense clouds of brown and grey smoke coming up. And now our skipper's talking to the glider pilot and warning him that we are nearly there, preparing to cast him off. Ahead of us, another pillar of black smoke marks the spot where an aircraft has gone down. And yet another one. It's a Stirling, a British Stirling. It's going down with flames coming out from under its belly.
Oh, sir.
And more parachutes are coming out. One, two, three, four, two, four. four parachutes have come out of the Stirling. It goes on its way to the ground, but we haven't got time to watch it further because we're coming up now to the exact chosen landing ground where our airborne forces have to be put down. And no matter what the opposition may be, we have got to keep straight on, dead on, to the exact position. There's only a minute or two to go. We've crossed the Rhine. We're on the east bank of the river. We are passing now over the army smoke cloud. Down there I see tanks moving forward along a road. More tanks moving across
the
field.
Hello, glider pilot. Hello,
we're quite low down now.
Bombing are calling.
At less than 3,000 feet.
You are approaching your army point now.
To see individuals on the ground.
Stand by and I'll tell you to come down.
The pilot is calling up the glider, warning him.
Cross that, okay, glider.
Now, in just one moment, we shall let go. All over the sky ahead of us. Here comes the point.
Now.
The glider has gone. We've cast off our glider. Our glider's gone. We let her go. There she goes down behind us. We turn hard away in a tight circle to port to get out of this area. I'm sorry if I'm shouting. This is a very tremendous sight. Halifax is now streaming across underneath us and let their gliders...
Okay, Scotty, why don't you rope go?
Okay, behind us.
Coming in. Now we're watching in front and behind to see if there are any enemy fighters. Touch wood, we haven't spotted one yet. Now the pilot gives us full boost.
What's your new course, Dick?
And off we go on the course home. The gliders are going down now, free suddenly from the slipstream of the bombers, but dropping, dropping like great dark moths, free from the force of the bombers, and slowly floating down to earth, down to the clouds that are coming up from their landing ground. There lies the battle zone right under us as we turn back, a patchwork of fields. No human movement, only the smoke coming from the bombers that have gone down, those of our force that have been lost. And now over there on our starboard bow, fighters streaking in. They're obviously after somebody. They're coming up fast. It's all right. They're our own typhoons keeping up an anti-flak patrol. Over the starboard of us as we come back over the Rhine, the guns are firing, raising great guns of grey smoke. There's another aircraft down, I see it. It just hit the ground at first. I think it's a fighter. I'm afraid that I've never seen more aircraft go down in a short time, but I still do not think that we've suffered very badly in this putting down of the greatest single airborne force ever taken anywhere. There now is the smoke of the guns firing on the battlefront behind us. We're going to snap out now, making for home. No sense saying about here when we can get away. Navigator's calling up for his course, the skipper's giving it to him. The gliders now have settled out of sight. They're circling down to their landing ground. And all I can see as we come away from the mist and the smoke that lies on the eastern bank of the Rhine are black pillars of fire and a grey mask, thick grey gun cloud as they float gently away in the breeze beyond the river.
And so the towing planes left for home, having done their best to land the gliders in position. Unfortunately, the wireless transmitter carried by Stanley Maxted on that fateful day was smashed on landing. But even though he, like Sergeant Hill, was wounded, he managed, 2 days later, to record this report. First, he describes his landing.
This is Stanley Maxted speaking from Germany. I have just returned from the 6th British Airborne Division, during which I passed through the lines of the Scottish troops which knifed through to link up with the surrounded airborne men. Last night, I believe you heard Richard Dimbleby's account of the breakaway from our glider of the big Halifax that was towing us. Well, after that, there was just a minute or two of quiet as the great Hamilcar ran in with the sound of the rushing wind in her wings. Then, when just a few feet off the ground, pandemonium broke loose. The wicked snap of Spandau machine guns mixed with the slower bong of 20-millimeter incendiaries for just a fraction of a second before they started pricking out their trademark in the thin skin of the glider. Things seemed to happen too quickly for me to take them all in at once. There was an explosion that appeared to be inside my head. The smell of burnt cordite. I went down on one knee. Something hot and sickly was dripping over my right eye and off my chin and all over my clothes. There was a doom-like lurch and a great rending as smoke, dust, and daylight came from nowhere. I saw my pal, Peter Cattle, lying on one elbow with blood making a spider web over his face. One of the men was on the floor, staring fixedly at nothing as one of his legs, rigid in front of him, was quivering in convulsions like a stricken eel. I saw the Bren carrier go inexorably out of the nose of the glider, carrying the whole works ahead of it, and wiping two signalers off the top of it like flies. Even then, the bullets kept crashing through the wreckage. It didn't seem fair, but then there's no fair or unfair in airborne fighting. At the moment of impact, a jeep trailer that was chained just behind me came forward about 6 inches and caught me in the small of the back. Mercifully, the chains held on. Somehow, Peter and I hurled ourselves out of the mess into a shallow ditch by a hedge. Looking up and clearing my eyes with the back of my hand, I saw a man pinned across the chest by wreckage. His legs were thrashing around as though someone were tickling him. One of the glider pilots was getting him out. How those glider pilots and the two signalers on top of the carrier escaped the mass of that hurtling iron carrier, I'll never know, but they did. A doctor came along and dressed Peter and me and helped us to a dressing station. On the way, I saw burning gliders, crashed gliders, and the great courage of men going into fight almost before they'd finished touching down. It was the old story of the men with the maroon berries who never worry about odds. The ground was covered with a mist of smoke from our artillery bombardment, and that was what had made it nearly impossible for the men to find their landing zones and spots. We spent the next 4 hours with that regiment. We had to. When contact was made with the men on our left, we made our painful way through them to Divisional HQ. Here, that remarkable young firebrand, their general, told us that all objectives had been reached and that when the Second Army linked up, he would hand them over in good shape and his job would be done. That has now taken place. One of the happy moments of the day was to see Major Roy Oliver intact at headquarters, and as dark fell, we tried to curl up into the familiar slip trench. All night long, the guns roared behind us, and the planes droned overhead. The enemy counterattacked, but the line held everywhere. And that's how the matter stood as I came away.
Later, he describes what happened at Hemmingkeln.
It wasn't until the evening of the day we landed that I found out that the haze obscuring the landing and dropping zones was artificial fog spread by the enemy. There was no height to it at all. It just lay along the ground and gave the enemy a good view of the gliders coming in while keeping out of sight himself. After getting away from the wreckage and scrambling along on our faces in a ditch beside a hedge, we went behind the railway, which was on a low embankment, until we came to a station. This showed us that the railway we'd come down on was one away over by the Isel River, and the station was Hemmingkeln Station, about 1,000 yards east of the town by that name, which was one of our final objectives. The clock in the station was still going, the ticket racks were full of tickets, which notices out in the waiting room said the German public must not use unless it was absolutely necessary, and the booking clerk's peaked cap was lying just inside the wicket on a table. Out beyond the platform was a line of boxcars, beyond which was a row of trees, a narrow field, and then the Isel River. Men were standing between the boxcars and firing. Others were lying at the bases of some of the trees beyond with Bren guns and automatic rifles. Smack in the middle of the booking hole on the floor was a wireless set with its fishing rod aerial and a signaler sitting beside it listening. Coming through those headphones just then were sounds of some of Germany's best remaining troops in a terrible state of nerves calling through to their command posts that they were surrounded or under fire or being attacked, and please send up guns or tanks, send up anything. I remember thinking that this struck me as being the shape of things to come. A major with a lisp who had discarded his helmet and put his red beret back on, was kneeling by a window looking through binoculars at some farm buildings behind us. Out by the boxcars, a man was setting up a mortar. There was a crack from the buildings the major was looking at, and the major yelled, "I've got the so-and-so mortar, left 1 degree, 3 rounds gunfire." I watched while the loading number out there dropped 3 fan-tailed demons in the muzzle of the mortar. They banged out high into the air, and the second one obliterated a sort of dovecot in the end of a low barn among the buildings. The major called, "That's it, that's got him, give him 3 more. There was no more sniping from those farm buildings. Down toward the river beyond the trees, a company of men was deployed. The glider-borne troops involved in this part of the action wear the badges of 3 very famous old county regiments. In some other setting, their actions might have reminded you of some nursery game. One section would rise up and go forward like Indian bushfighters. They'd be covered by fire from the rest. Then another section went forward in the same way until all the platoons had worked their way in a converging movement onto the bridge that was one of their objectives. Heavy, crashing bangs and clouds of black smoke started to come down among them. A gunner, FOO, got on the wireless set and called up medium guns miles back on the other side of the Rhine. He gave them map coordinates. A couple of rounds came down. He gave them a slight correction and ordered 10 rounds gunfire. Now, 10 rounds gunfire from those guns is quite a party. And the enemy self-propelled guns that were causing the trouble evidently found themselves right in the middle of it. And so it went. It really is an occasion to watch these airborne troops fight. When they first come out of their gliders with magazines blazing to fight for their landing zone, it's more or less of a scramble, but from then on, their operations are coldly, deadly methodical. I heard that a link-up had been made with another county regiment that had dropped on our right, and that the third, behind us, had captured and cleared Hamilkeln. That was what I was waiting for. It meant that I could pick my way gingerly back to divisional headquarters some miles away. Down the road, a building still blazed and a glider wrecked and burned around it. Lying beside the building was the charred body in a jumping smock. Over in the field beyond, a German 20-millimeter AK-AK battery sat with its guns pointing skyward. The gun crew was sprawled around the gun in its circular emplacement. Around the corner, a windmill stood with its arms outstretched and a field gray-clad German hanging out over a sort of windowsill near the top. In Hamilkeln, cocky West Country troops were the only soldiers in evidence, and all was quiet in the houses. After walking through the town, I came to one of the spaces where a parachute regiment had dropped. An American boy with a Stars and Stripes flag sewed on his shoulder lay as though he was just sleeping peacefully in the sun. There was a tiny stain on the chest of his blouse. Somebody had got him before he could unhook his parachute. I suppose he was one of the liaison men, because this operation was very much an Allied one. The U.S. Airborne had put down the 17th Airborne Division to the south of us. A Canadian gunner with his driver came along in a jeep and gave us a lift. The us being Captain Peter Cattle of the Airborne Public Relations Section and myself. Peter's face was a sight. He looked as though somebody had hit him with a bottle of ketchup and he'd just let it dry there. We found divisional headquarters in a cluster of farm buildings in the middle of a lot of plowed country. The plowed country was dotted with parachutes of all colors and with gliders. We found the young general of the 6th Airborne standing beside a jeep in an orchard. Around him, a lot of white chickens were behaving almost like cats, making chuckling sounds around his feet. I almost expected to see one of the hens rub up against his leg. He gave us the overall picture as it then stood and explained that as long as he could hold off counterattacks during the night, he'd be in nice, tidy shape by morning to meet the Second Army. What a dynamic man he is. I shouldn't be surprised to learn that he'd captained his football team not so many years ago. over in an enclosed space were such prisoners as had already come back this far. Hundreds of them they were, and as far as I could see, all first-rate troops. They've just been beaten by better ones, that's all. One of the outstanding moments, as far as I was concerned, was to see in the chilly daybreak of next morning what looked like a dust storm coming up the unfenced dirt road past headquarters. The dust was being made by a number of lovely Sherman tanks careering up the road at speed. Peter and I stood and watched them go by. Out of his battered face came, "That's the stuff to give the blighters. That's clinched it."
And it did. That was the story of the 6th Airborne Division at the crossing of the Rhine and the battle for Hemminkeln.